Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Norman Ornstein, a contributing writer for The Atlantic, a contributing editor and columnist for The National Journal, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research, and the author of numerous books, most recently the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitution System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann, now in an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was. And he's co-author of One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. Welcome to Background Briefing, Norman Ornstein.
Very good to be with you, Ian.
And let me start with, you responded to the opinion writer in the Washington Post, Paul Wolman's essay about the current power of the current tyranny of the minority, if you will, in American politics. But let me start with Paul Wolman's tweet. In the age of minority rule, a Supreme Court justice appointed by a president who got fewer votes is confirmed by a party in the Senate that got fewer votes to validate policies opposed by most Americans. And if people think that it's bad, it's going to get worse, the trend.
Absolutely going to get worse in a whole host of ways. And, you know, my response to him, which was something that I mentioned to the shock of a lot of people every time I speak about American politics, is that if you look at population by state, and the World Population Review does this annually, right now, over two-thirds of Americans live in 15 states. And with the population projections, by 2040 or so, 70% of Americans will live in 15 states. And what that means, just in terms of the Senate, is that 30% of Americans will select 70 senators, more than enough to override any vetoes, to enact treaties, to overcome any filibusters, assuming that there are any filibuster rules, but also to pass laws, obviously, that will not necessarily reflect the broader needs, desires, or will of the vast majority. And while we have a republic, and lots of people just sort of parrot back, it's a republic, not a democracy, the whole notion of a republic is that you will elect representatives who broadly reflect the public desires and will. And we're moving further and further away from that. And of course, the 30% are in states that are more rural, more poor, tend to be less educated, and certainly far less diverse than the country as a whole. It's something that should make almost every American who wants to have a system where there's a broad sense of legitimacy in the outcomes of elections and of policy very nervous.
So if we're heading to the point where 30% of the population of the country will control 68% of the seats in the U.S. Senate, or even worse, half of the population of the country will control 84% of these seats. The point is, and just in case the audience has missed the point of our conversation, we're talking about red states. We're talking about the Republicans, a minority party controlling the Senate into the future.
That's, you know, it's. I should add, though, Ian, it's not even so much about party more generally. Let me take this to another level, because, of course, as these populations move, it adds to the distortion of the Electoral College, which already gives significant weight to the smaller states. You know, from the time that we first really began to count popular votes, they didn't mean very much in the early days. 1824 was the first election where there was any real significance. And if you move that forward through 1996, 44 elections, you could argue that one of those had a clear-cut result where the winner of the presidency lost the popular vote. One out of 44. Since then, two out of five elections. The first time in 2000, of course, the most contested election in more than a century at minimum, 36 days before we got an outcome, the winner of the popular vote, Al Gore, losing the presidency by a single vote in the 5-4 verdict of the Supreme Court. But the public basically said, hey, look, we needed a resolution of this. Those are the rules. It's like a tennis match. It's not how many games you win. It's how many sets you win. And Gore himself reinforced that with his concession. But the second time it happened, this time, 3 million votes separating the winner and the loser, with the winner losing that popular vote. There was much more sense of discontent over the outcome. We're going to have more of those. The third time, the fourth time, how many people are going to believe it's legitimate? Now, if we want to look at this through a partisan lens, it's absolutely the case that states that are less diverse, poorer, less educated, more rural, are going to tend to be more Republican. But I think even more broadly, what we see is a Republican Party that's using some of these distortions in the Electoral College, the partisan gerrymandering in the House, as well as what's happening in the Senate, and adding to it a substantial dose of voter suppression through draconian laws, not just about voter ID, but also restricting the days in which you could have early voting, changing the polling places and the times of elections so that minorities have less opportunity to vote. Using those tools, with the courts aiding and abetting, to basically ensure that they can have significant control over policy, even when a clear majority of voters don't want that to happen. That's not a good development.
Well, it seems that our president is concerned about it, shall we say, or at least it gets under his skin, because at the extraordinarily craven press conference with Vladimir Putin yesterday in Helsinki, he went off and revisited the election again and talked about this great Electoral College victory. So it obviously bothers Trump, but do you think it bothers the Republicans at large?
You know, we're going to find out over time whether the vast majority of Republicans who both approve of Trump and basically change their positions to adapt to anything that he says will start to get shaken in any fashion from some of those more brutal realities. Right now, I'm not particularly sanguine.
Well, at this point, just to touch on that yesterday, because I'm sure you have an opinion, and many people do you think that that could have been a turning point, that there is something stirring in the broader zeitgeist, that something, to quote Hamlet, something's rotten in the state of Denmark?
If yesterday didn't shake them, I don't know what would, and that includes shooting somebody in broad daylight on Fifth Avenue. What I did notice a bit, and I tried to look at how this was being covered across different platforms, I did notice that at least during the day, Fox News was a little more honest in terms of looking at the downsides of that utterly disastrous press conference in Helsinki that the president had with Vladimir Putin. That changed during the evening hours, and of course we saw basically sycophancy from Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson and some of the others. And, you know, I don't know how this will get filtered through a lot of people. We're seeing a different reaction from some members of Congress, although that different reaction is still relatively limited criticism, except for people like John McCain and Richard Burr. I've got to believe that at least some of the suburban audience that's been receptive to the Trump clarion call will begin to have more second thoughts now. And maybe this is going to cause at least some decline in enthusiasm from Republicans about their options in 2018. But it's been pretty stunning to see how his appeals to his base over and over again are met with an almost automatic acceptance, even when he just changes positions from what have been core Republican talking points and values, especially when it comes to Russia and dictators.
Well, his explanation today was literally, the dog ate my homework. He said it really comes down to the one word, would, when I meant to say wouldn't. Now, if anybody believes that, I don't know. Tucker Carlson, of course, said that Mexico's interfered in our elections, not Russia. So we have obviously a real reality deficit here. But just back to the issue of, I think the fact that Trump exposed his weakness and cravenness and raised suspicions that even have invited the T-word treason now to be entering the political debate. Again, to my mind, that's just going to make the Democrats even lazier, or at least in the sense that they've always run on the platform, that we're not the other guy. And in this case, they've been running on that platform ever since Trump became president, and talk of impeachment, which certainly backfires. So given the fact that the Democrats have an automatic deficit of about 8%, in other words, they've got to get 8% more votes to even break even because of what we're talking about, the gerrymandering and the Electoral College. What's your prognosis then in terms of, will they get a narrative? Will they get the people out to vote that didn't vote the last time? And will this reliance on we're not the other guy work? I mean, obviously at the moment they're thinking, if you listen to what Schumer and Nancy Pelosi are saying, they're basically saying, that this guy may be owned by Putin and may be compromised. But I'm not sure that's going to move the needle.
It's an unknown at this point. That phenomenon worked for Republicans like a charm in 2010 and 2014. There was no larger message or agenda beyond elect us so we can stop this Kenyan socialist from destroying the country. Now, I would give you a caveat on that, which is that what usually happens in a midterm contest, and it's what happened when there's a wave in 2010 and 2014, is that the president's party is disillusioned and depressed and stays home, and the opposite party is angry and turns out. But we're so driven by negative partisanship now that Trump's appeal to Republicans, it's not about me, it's about keeping those evil people from taking over, might get a larger turnout. That's one part of it. But the second part of it that we have to keep the focus on, laser-like focus, is what the Russians will do in November. I will tell you, Ian, I haven't seen any thorough analysis of some of these things. But when almost 200,000 votes in Los Angeles County during the primary were basically invalidated because of what they said was a glitch in the system, something I've never seen before with numbers at that level. And that was followed a few weeks later by 80,000 votes in Maryland through what was called a mistake in the Motor Vehicle Administration. It made me wonder whether these are beta tests by Russia in blue states where people aren't going to pay as much attention to resuming their interference in the elections in November. We know that they have, at minimum, they were able to purchase through a company Maryland's voter registration lists. We know that they tapped into the voter registration lists of other states. If you do that and you change a middle initial in some of the names, or reverse a couple of the letters in the name, or change one digit in the last four of the Social Security number, you can end up with large numbers of people who are told when they go to the polls, no, you're not registered. And some of them are just going to go home. Others may say, I want to file a provisional ballot. And those provisional ballots will get counted in California and Maryland. But if this happens in Ohio or Florida, where you have Republican election officials who have deep-sixed provisional ballots before, that could change the outcome of the election. And whether anything can be done about it remains to be seen. And we certainly haven't seen any sense of urgency in Congress to deal with this problem. And I find that particularly troubling right now.
Well, just a final reality check in the last minute. Isn't it true that the Democrats have got to take the House and the Senate and particularly state houses in this upcoming election in November in order to reverse gerrymandering with the 2020 census? And by the way, they're stacking the census by trying to discourage minorities.
I think there's no doubt that this is by far the most significant midterm election in our lifetimes. And if Democrats do not find it an ability to take at least one house of Congress, God knows what kinds of laws will follow.
Well, Norman Ornstein, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Absolutely, Ian. Good to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Norman Ornstein, who's a contributing writer for The Atlantic, a contributing editor and columnist for The National Journal, and a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He's the author of numerous books, most recently the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann. Now, in an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was. And he's the co-author of One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.